welcome all. And if we have any guests with us tonight, you can join if you'd like to. Don't feel obliged to do so. But I will post into the chat, if I can find the right stuff, I'll post it at some point, how you can go to our website and join the group. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Alan better unmute himself. Okay, thank you, Chris. And here we go. So to start with, I've got a part two of trying to speed up the old Windows computer. So if you remember, we have a number of people that have slow computers, and we're going to take a look and see what we can do. But first of all, a follow-up from last week. I'd indicated there was a cleanup button in the bottom left-hand corner of PC Manager down here. And it didn't seem to do very much. Chris figured out why. And these two things down here are basically tabs. So when you load PC Manager, it comes up in with this window right here. If you click on the security button here, you go off to a scan your PC for threats window. And if you hit cleanup again, then you actually go back to square one. And the start. So these are actually tabs on the bottom of the program window, which is quite novel. But Microsoft has never been known to do things consistently from one app to the next. So it makes perfect sense to somebody. Okay, so we've been playing around with using PC Manager, the Windows cleanup boosting performance system. And we've been trying to use it to see how to clean up files that we don't need. And if you remember, we looked at disk cleanup on one of my computers, and I had about 400 megabytes of kind of temporary files. PC Manager, we hit boost, and it seemed as though it got rid of 1.4 gigabytes of files in like no seconds. Somehow I managed to hit the cleanup button and got rid of 153 megabytes, but since that didn't do anything, I'm not quite sure what happened there. And we still got storage management, which is telling us we've got 4.8 gigabytes of something, but we don't know what. So here's our starting point for now. Drive C has 3.7 gigabytes of free space. And this cleanup is still showing about 400 megabytes of temporary files. So if we open PC Manager, and instead of using boost, which was the big blue button here, if we start going down the options in the sections in the left hand side here, the actual PC Manager window, the first one we come to is health check. So if we hit the button here for health check, then it brings up this screen and it tells us that we've got about 1.1 gigabytes that items that PC Manager says it can clean up, and it breaks them out by various categories. So you've got Windows cache and browser cache, temporary files, and so forth. So it wants to get rid of 1.1 gigabytes, so let's tell it to proceed, I think. Yes, proceed. And what it says is that it's completed, but that doesn't actually tell us very much. So what we need to do is go back to the main window here and see what actually happened. So here's what we had before. We had 1.1 gigabytes ready to be cleaned up in these categories. And after we run proceed, we look at health check again, and now we've only got 24 megabytes of files that can be cleaned up. So it clearly has cleaned up a bunch of this 1 gigabyte of stuff here. Now we can run this thing again. We've got 24 megabytes, so we're going to hit proceed, and now it says we've got nothing to clean up. So it's clearly done something. So let's take a look at how we're doing. If you remember, we had 3.7 or so gigabytes free. Now we've run this health check and the proceed to clean up the things that were there. We're up to 4.6 gigabytes free. So we've cleaned up about, or PC Manager has cleaned up about one gigabyte of temporary files and created an extra gigabyte of free space. However, if we go back and look at disk cleanup again, nothing much happened on the disk cleanup front. We've still got 400 meg or so of temporary files, either in the regular disk cleanup, or if we hit the cleanup system files, then there's an extra 96 meg over here. And one of the interesting things, if we look at all these categories, the categories in the regular one and the categories in the system files, you can see that you've got quite a bit of overlap. The things that are highlighted in red or circled in red are actually unique categories between the two disk cleanup systems. So disk cleanup has a thing called user file history, which doesn't appear in system files, but system files has Windows Update Cleaner. So if you update your system, and especially if you get one of these big feature updates, that thing can have 4 or 5 gigabytes of files sitting there waiting for you to roll back Windows to an earlier state, which you probably don't want to do. And it's got a thing for Defender, it's got a thing for the upgrade log files, device drivers, and language resource files. And those things, these red things here, don't appear over here. Whereas if you look down the list, download temporary Windows error reports, download temporary Windows error reports, there's some overlap between the two systems, but there are some differences. And if you look at PC Manager, its categories, well, the only thing that's common is temporary files. Windows cache, browser cache, system logs, recent file list. System logs may be some of these things over here. Windows error reports, feedback, Windows upgrade log files, they may be part of the system logs. But PC Manager doesn't tell us any more than this. however, let's move down and look at storage management. Storage management gives us a thing called deep cleanup. Well, deep cleanup sounds good, right? Perform a full cleanup scan. Ooh. So let's have a look at deep cleanup. So again, it's giving us various categories, and this time it's giving us categories and some files that it can get rid of. But it's also giving us some extra things here which are unchecked. And I think these things like DirectX, shader cache, I don't care about shader cache. So I'm happy to check that and that and that. Check everything that's unchecked and then basically proceed. And it says I've got 92 megabytes rather of items that can be cleaned up. I tell it to proceed. The cleanup's completed. It's cleaned out 100 megabytes or so or something, which is interesting. I guess it was approximately 92, but it was more like 102. And again, it says it's just clean. So we really don't know what that means. So again, if we go and have a look, we go back. Now in the cleanup, this is a deep cleanup. We've got 67 megabytes in these various categories. If we try and proceed, we've still got about 67 megabytes. So whatever these things are, Windows is holding onto them tightly. It doesn't want us to delete most of those things because most of them are still there. So presumably these are files which are current. Windows is using them and it's not prepared to delete them just now. However, by doing the various cleanup procedures there in more depth, as it were, we've now got to 4.8 gigabytes of free space, but we're still in this cleanup. We've still got our 400 megabytes of temporary files. Whatever we do in PC Manager, it doesn't seem to do very much, if anything, to this cleanup. So let's finally run disk cleanup. Let's clean up the files in the regular one, hit the cleanup system files, clean up the files in the system files. And now we're down to 2 megabytes in the regular and 24 megabytes in the system files. And again, these will presumably are files which are current, which disk cleanup or Windows doesn't want us to delete just yet. So they wait for another rainy day, I guess. However, after all that, we're now up to 5.1 gigabytes of free space from, if you remember, about 3.6, 3.7. So we've actually cleaned up about 1.5 gigabytes of space by using PC Manager to get rid of a whole bunch of stuff, and then following it up by using disk cleanup, using the regular and the system files to get rid of all the other temporary files. And as far as Windows is concerned, I think that's as good as she's going to get in terms of disk cleanup, maybe. So the next question is, what else can PC Manager do for us? And we're going to leave that until next week, and we'll find out. So in the meantime, Chris has a share here, a YouTube tech share.
Yeah, this is a YouTube video I came across, and it's, you know, with our YouTube tech, but it's not really YouTube tech, but I thought it was a very interesting video, so I thought I'd pass it on. So they talk in here about sharenting, which they define as being the common practice of parents sharing photos or videos of their children online. And some interesting stats, some of which came out of this video and some of which came from some other sources. Over 75% of parents share their kids' data on social media. That didn't really surprise me an awful lot. 8 out of 10 parents have followers they've never met. So if you're sharing something and you have followers that you don't know, you're sharing information with those potentially. This is a kind of a scary one. Average 5-year-old child has had 1,500 pictures uploaded online without their consent. Of course, as a 5-year-old child, they can't really give informed consent. But 1,500 pictures uploaded online by their parents. And there are some estimates that are out there that by 2030, nearly 2/3 of all identity fraud cases that are affecting younger people out there will have resulted from sharing things. So that idea of that their information is being shared online without their knowledge or consent, and it could well lead to identity fraud in the future. Next. So the video does go on to say, you know, go back one there, Alan.
Sorry.
So, yeah, go forward one.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So they go on to say things about the fact that sharing pictures, holiday celebrations, and so forth can be really nice. It does connect us and so forth, but you have to realize that once the information goes online, then that personal data is available worldwide indefinitely. Even if you remove it, you can't know whether somebody else has already copied that information. And we've all heard stories of, you know, horrific things where people had personal information shared and then they tried to get it removed, and it's really impossible to get it all removed. And in the video, they have this girl, Ella, and they describe a scenario which is not very unrealistic on what the unforeseen circumstances can be for Ella. Next. This is a link here that Alan actually came up with and passed on to me, and I added this slide on it. So it's all well and good to say, you know, okay, you shouldn't share information about private stuff about kids and things like that. But what do you do? And so how do you actually look at this intelligently and ensure that to the extent possible, this doesn't come back to bite you or your children? So the first point in this article is take photos consciously. So when you're taking photos, make sure that children in the photo are not recognizable. And they suggest that you can conceal faces. So use smileys, blur, mosaic effects to make sure that the faces are not recognizable. And you might have seen recently Mark Zuckerberg posted a photo of his family and his two older children. He actually had smiley faces pasted over top of their actual faces so that you couldn't recognize the features of the kid themselves. Interestingly, he did not do the same on his baby. I guess he figured that the baby's face would change enough before it could possibly affect them. But for whatever reason, he just did it with two older children. The next point is share wisely. And this is really to stop and think when you're actually sharing stuff, what are the potential impacts of this? And so really think carefully, who are you sharing it with? And, what are the possible negative outcomes that could come from this sharing? The next one I have a bit of a bugaboo with, use security settings. And I certainly say that you should take advantage of any security settings that are on social media platforms that you use. But they are not a panacea. There have been lots of cases where even with security settings locked down, all of a sudden they magically got changed to being wide open or things like that. Or people who were not supposed to be able to access the content actually could. Another danger, and this is something that Facebook has been guilty of on numerous occasions, when they add a new feature, they don't necessarily put it there as locked down. So you may find a new feature has been added to Facebook and its settings are wide open. So you start using that feature and you don't think to go check the security settings. Maybe you're sharing this information worldwide as opposed to only to your followers or whatever security setting you would prefer to have. Involve the children. So as children get old enough that they can actually, intelligently consume this information, talk to them, about the risks on the internet and sharing information online so that, and what you do in your approach to sharing information about them. But it's good for them to also start thinking, intelligently about how they share information with others online. And the last point I think is really important is if you have photos of other parents' children, don't post them without the permission of the parents of that. And if they just say, oh yeah, sure, share anything, maybe they need to have a talking with about the dangers of too much sharing of personal information of children. So the URLs for that are in the chat. I highly recommend that people take a look at those and pass them on to other people that you think it would be appropriate to pass them on to.
I don't see what the dangers are. If you're going to identity thieve a kid's identity, what advantage is it for you?
For one thing, it could be used to kidnap a child. If you share information about, their name, where they live, and things like that, you could have somebody who pulls up in front of a kid outside of a park and say, "Oh, Jimmy, your dad wanted me to drive you home. Yeah, I know you could be safe. I know you live at such and such an address." And so you might trust somebody that you don't. As well, it could come back to haunt them in unknown ways as they grow up older as well.
So you're talking about rich kids, not ordinary kids.
Not necessarily. Well, I don't know. I mean, if you have somebody who's going to assault children or something like that, it doesn't have to be a rich kid that gets assaulted. I tend to agree with this, is like, be careful about the information that you share.
Is it me or is it lunatic to put pictures of your children on the web with smiley faces? I don't see the point.
Yeah, I don't know about that one either. In that case, I guess it was the idea that Zuck wanted to post a photo of him at some park or something like that. And he decided that although he wanted to post this, he wanted to protect the identity of his children or whatever. And so he did that. So I think more to the point is really just the idea that, be careful about the information you share. If they are identifiable, it could potentially lead to a problem.
It may make a difference if you're a multi-billionaire.
Anyway. Go ahead, Tom.
It may make a difference if you're a multi-billionaire, what your kids look like, and maybe people will could see them and think of kidnapping them. But I think for ordinary kids, I think the main disadvantage would be that, pictures in school might be, if you're pictured as a kid somewhere, you might be embarrassed by where you are and so on. I think that would be the main danger rather than people being picked up and so on. I think the danger of strangers is greatly exaggerated. I mean, the main danger to kids is relatives.
Could be. But there is the idea, too, that why not err on the side of caution? Do you really need to post pictures of your kids online? I don't know.
Do you really need to post anything on Facebook?
Yeah. There was
if you're concerned, Chris, why would you not, rather than use Facebook, why wouldn't you use a personal website and you only give out the URL to people you know?
Well, it's certainly a more along the lines of what's on the slide now. Think consciously about, the photos you are posting. Share wisely. Think about what it is that you're actually sharing. An interesting thing I came across a number of years ago, there's a law in France, or there was at the time anyways, a new law that had been passed that children could actually sue their parents for information and photos that they had shared online before they had the right or the ability to give informed consent. And so there are some people that are taking it seriously.
Okay, moving along.
Can I just say something?
Yep.
I remember years and years ago when I was a kid, before anything went digital, people would go to cemeteries and look at death dates, which had birth dates, to get IDs that way.
Yeah.
Now you have it more digital and easy to get.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. So it's less suspicious to walk around cemeteries now.
Okay, next up we have a loony bit from our friend in Shawinigan.
Good evening, all. Another loony bit for your enjoyment. I came across this site some time ago when I was researching a band a deceased cousin had been involved with when he was young. I never did take the time to learn about it at the time, but doing some web searching led to some information on this site, CanadianBands.com, which seems to be a one-man operation, not too professional, slick, but very interesting, with a lot of information. It's got your basic home search page, artists, discographies. One section is in memoriam of past artists who have passed away, and some interviews with various artists and reviews. Well, God, don't we just love to talk about other people's music and what we think of it? Everyone's a critic. And sort of a timeline of Canadian music. I will say popular Canadian music history, because I think people think music didn't exist before recordings. But that's the only timeline that people have a record of. No pun intended. Anyway. When I shared the information about the website with the group, the homepage the landing page for the homepage had a help wanted posting on it saying that they were looking for financial aid and or a sponsor, like this one that Alan just put up for me. Thank you, Alan. The fellow was saying he needed help. And I was a little concerned that if it was disappearing before I shared information about this, well, you guys might not find out about your favorite band and some of the things they got up to, because Wikipedia doesn't have every story about every band that you might be interested in, particularly the Canadian ones. You know, we get up to things that doesn't make it into Wikipedia. Anyway, not much more to say about this. The help for a sponsor page seems to have disappeared, and he's now got a submission page coming soon as his landing page, but the site is still up, and there's all kinds of interesting data on your favorite Canadian artist and or band that you may not know, or you may know. I mean, you could contribute. Think of it. Go down in history. Anyway, that's all I've got tonight.
Thanks, Stuart. Okay, next up we have a share essentially from Jeff Dubois, but Chris is going to tell us all about it.
Yeah, so Jeff came up with this scenario of something that had been bugging him a little bit. And so basically the routine he goes through when he starts up each day, he turns on the computer, and then he goes and makes coffee while Windows loads. He comes back to his computer, and he starts up his mail client. And then he waits for the email client to load. And then he waits for the IMAP folders to sync. He's on a relatively slow connection at the cottage, and so this may take some amount of time. And then he actually gets down to where he can actually read his email. So he wondered if this could be streamlined. So instead, how about if you could turn on your computer, go make coffee while Windows loads, the mail client loads, and the IMAP folders all sync. You walk back to your computer with your cup of coffee and you start reading your email directly. So rather than going back to your computer and having to do a whole bunch more stuff and wait for things to happen before you can actually read your email, how about if while you're making your coffee, you get those extra things actually happen as well? Well, sure enough, you can do it in Windows. So it's auto-starting of programs. And you'll find that you probably have a whole bunch of things that are auto-starting on your computer. A lot of applications, when you install them, they will set themselves to auto-start so that they are available to you immediately as soon as you get to your desktop. So Windows can auto-start any programs, really, when Windows loads up, and in particular, once you've logged in. So a lot of programs require the context of you being logged in before they can actually run. So some programs can auto-start before you log in, but some programs will only auto-start after you've logged into the computer. So this is good for any program that you normally start up every time you use your computer. So whether that's your browser like Firefox or PowerPoint, if you're always working on new decks or something like that, or Microsoft Word, if you always get down to work on writing documents, or you're using something like Lightroom or a photo editing program, and you always use it every time you use your computer, why not have it auto start? Or, as in the case with Jeff Dubois, Thunderbird mail client. So how do you do that? So the easiest way to auto-start a program that is not currently auto-starting is press the Win plus the R key, and you'll get a run dialog box come up on the screen. Type in shell:startup, and you'll get a File Explorer window. And that window will be anchored at your personal startup folder, which is under C, Users, Username, App Data, Roaming, Microsoft, Windows, Start Programs, Programs, Startup. So that's where your startup folder is. There is another startup folder that is for everybody that's on the computer. And so you could have it put in something that would start up regardless of how you're logged into the computer. But normally what you want to do is personal for when you log onto the computer. And then you press WinR again, and you'll get another run dialog box, and you type in shell:apps folder. And then it'll open up another Explorer window, opened at what is the title of the File Explorer window is called Applications. Get those so you can see them both on the screen at the same time. And then next. So you drag and drop any apps from the Applications folder to the Startup one. And it doesn't matter if you left-click or right-click, it won't remove them from the applications folder. The applications folder should be all of the programs that are installed on your computer. Okay? And so once you do that, where you drag and drop them into that folder, they will be auto-started the next time Windows loads on your computer and you log into the computer. Okay, so the applications folder is all of the stuff that's been installed on your computer. So what about portable apps? So portable apps are applications on your computer that don't require an installation program to run them. So they can be just something you download from the internet, that you just run it, and it works. And you don't actually do an install. But if you don't do an install, it'll never appear on your start menu, and it doesn't appear in the applications window if you follow those previous instructions. Those are only programs that have been installed that'll end up appearing on your start menu or in the application folder. So if you have any programs that don't appear in the application window, I'm not going to go through it in here, but if you follow the instructions that are on the Quick Tip 31, and I don't know if I actually popped that in. No, I don't think I did. I pasted it into the chat now. So Quick Tip 31 that came out 2 years ago has both the previous tips were in there, as well as how to add a program that doesn't appear in the applications window or in the start menu. And so if you check that out, you can take care of that extra instance.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Jeff notes it was actually Outlook Mail client.
Oh, okay.
From Office, but since you said it can work for all programs, I guess it works for Outlook Mail, huh?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, thanks very much. So next up, we have a presentation from Linda.
Wait a second. One comment on that. Sometimes when you start up a program, you need to give it some command line arguments or parameters that, for example, will cause Outlook to automatically download the mail or start up the IMAP or something like that. I don't know what it is. For Pegasus, there are a few parameters, and there are other things as well. Other programs have other parameters. So you may want to look into that. If you put something in your auto start menu, you may want to actually add the parameters. But you may have to do that using a shortcut.
Yeah, good point. If you have a special icon that is starting up a program with extra parameters or whatever it is, you could drag and drop that into your auto start, your startup folder, as opposed to the one that appears in the applications folder. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So, Linda next with a item on PowerPoint.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alan. So I wanted to talk about making a PowerPoint for a memorial. This came up recently because my aunt passed away a few weeks ago, and I wanted to contribute something to her memorial event, which was more a celebration of life. And she had an only child, my cousin, and I knew he was up to his neck in arranging the cremation and cleaning out her apartment and trying to start the executor stuff. So I thought, well, I could take this on and see if I could put together something for that day. Now, I know probably some of you are thinking, well, why don't you just throw a pile of photos and have it run in the background of your, like a slideshow on your laptop, like a screensaver. But I didn't, I'm just going to try and show you some of the advantages to PowerPoint if you just take that little extra time and effort that it would take to do a PowerPoint. So obviously, it is something nice that you can contribute, but you do have to ask for permission. You can't just show up with your laptop and say, oh, here's some photos. Let's set it up over here. So, and the person that's closest to the closest family to the deceased relative may want to include photos, but I certainly wasn't going to ask my cousin. I knew he'd be too busy, and I knew all his photos were in the garage. So I just told him I was going to do it. He liked the idea. And then I went out and collected no more than four or five photos from a few relatives, because a lot, you know, are not, they're not as organized as me. I'm kind of the family archivist. So they've got photos in their garage or deep in their basement. So I wasn't going to have them spend weeks on this. But for sure, a few did come up with some photos, and I was happy to see that, because obviously they were different from mine. So while I was waiting for them to send me their photos, I scanned some of my old photos or sorted my digital ones, and I was ready to go when I received the ones from my relatives. So I would recommend at least 30 photos, because this is going to play over and over, and you don't want it to get too boring. You don't want to see, you know, five photos. It's going to get pretty monotonous. So I at least 30. I think I had 50, and that seemed quite nice. And then recommend that you choose a fairly simple PowerPoint presentation. Obviously, you're not looking for wow factor. You're not looking to put in a pie chart or anything like that. You know, no bullets and things. So it's just using PowerPoint as a device to run a looping series of photos. Next. So the first thing you do after you open a new PowerPoint document is you go to the Design tab. There aren't many choices, but you can modify them all. If there's little, I didn't cover it in this presentation, but if there's little graphics, you can get rid of those. But in this instance, I just picked a plain colored one, but say I wanted to change that color, you can do so. So next. So a little dialog box is off to the right for formatting the background. Just click on the picture icon, and then you go down and you can select the color, you can change saturation. There's a whole bunch of things you can do to modify the template. So in this instance, I'm just picking one sort of green, a little softer color, and don't forget to hit apply to all, otherwise it's only going to apply to that one slide. Next. Okay, so now you've got your first slide in the color you like, and you're going to insert some photos. Now, you could just go to Explorer and copy and then go back to PowerPoint and paste them in, but I prefer to just stay in the same program, so I just click on Insert Pictures from this device. Next. And it'll open up your Explorer. You just go find your photos as you normally would, and then next. You just select the photos you want. In this instance, I just selected a few for this demonstration, and you click on Insert. So you can pick more than one photo at a time. You don't have to keep going back and back and back and selecting photos. You can pick a group of photos and insert it. Okay, next. So here they are, and so they come in all in the first slide. Well, obviously, I need to have some more slides to put these photos on. So next. So you just go up to the new slide tab as any other PowerPoint, and you just pick the blank one. Again, we don't want bullets, we don't want pie charts, so you just click on blank. And then next. And then once you've added one blank one, you can just hit copy and go paste, and it'll just do as many slides, empty slides as you want. So then you click on the first one and you do a cut and paste it into the blank slide below, and then you do the same thing with the other ones. It's just faster than going and picking one picture at a time. Next. So here they are, and when you paste them into your blank slides, they might look a little small. So you just drag the corners, and it keeps the aspect ratio, so there's no problem with that, and you just pull it around till you get it positioned on the slide the way you want. Next. So then you want to maybe put a little border around the picture frame or something like that to make it. And these are the kind of extra things you can do in PowerPoint that you can't do if it's just a straight slideshow. So you click to get the picture format tab, you have to click on the photo. Otherwise, that menu does not appear. So that's important. So click on the photo. Then you get picture format. And then you've got a choice of different types of framing. And one of the ones that's kind of cool, I didn't show it an example here, but that one that you see that's a circle with a little shadow under it, that's kind of fun. I've used that one on occasion. But next. I'll show you the ones that I have selected for this. So here's one with just a plain black frame and then thin next. And then there's ones with the kind of rounded corners, which is sort of looks like the old fashioned. Next. And then this one I like, it's just a bit of a shadow behind it. And in this particular instance, I didn't want random photos coming up because I wanted them in the kind of chronological order of her life. So next. And so the thing that's nice with the PowerPoint is you can add some captions if you wish. I wasn't going to caption every photo. Most of the people that were coming to this event knew the host, which was her son and daughter-in-law, so I didn't need to label those. But not everybody knew that I was her niece. Not everybody would recognize her grandson because he's now in his 20s. So that was kind of nice just to be able to put a little caption on a few of them. And then next. You can select the font and all the usual things that Windows allows you to do, center it, left justify, whatever, and try and pick a font that doesn't look too formal, a little more casual or social. Next. And then, you know, if you want to add an embellishment or something like that, you can just go to the insert pictures and just go online. You can find some clip art or whatever, or go to your favorite site like PNG site and get nice. So this was obviously Christmas. We were all in red. And so just something I could throw in. Next. So now you want to have the transitions. And you get lots of choices in PowerPoint. And I like the reveal because it was a very soft change. Again, this isn't a business presentation. You just want it to kind of fade a little bit in and out. So I chose that one. It was a really nice soft transition and I didn't mix it up. I find that irritating if it's a relatively short presentation, something like this. You don't really want the mood jarring from one type of transition to another. I don't anyway. So I just kept with the reveal. Next. Next. Okay. And then you want to set the timing so that it advances after X number of seconds. Now, in this instance, I did 5 seconds, which seemed enough for people to look at it, read the caption if there was one, comment if they wanted to. But you could set it for longer if you wanted to, especially if you didn't have too many photos. Next. And then next. And then don't forget to hit apply to all because that's, sorry, there's a bit of a delay here. I'm sorry, Ellen. I know you're hitting things and it's not coming up. So then I say it again and then you go on. Okay, so you have to hit apply to all, otherwise it will only transition one slide. Okay, next. Thank you. So now we want to loop the entire presentation because you don't want to have to get up and start the presentation again every time it's finished the 30 photos or whatever. So you just go to slideshow, you hit set up slideshow, and then next, it gives you this dialog box, and you just say loop continuously until somebody hits escape, and then that's obviously the end of your session. Then what happens is obviously, unless you take the time to resize every photo that you put in, some of the photos are going to be pretty big. And so the PowerPoint ends up pretty big. So if you do want to share it, I shared it with all the relatives that weren't able to attend. They were on Zoom, but they couldn't see the PowerPoint. I had 2 laptops going there. So I wanted to share it online, and I didn't want to eat up too much of my Dropbox space. So you just can click, when you do a save as, you can click on the tools menu and hit compress, and that will compress all the photos and the file, and you get a nice size. As small as PowerPoint as you can. Next. And then you can select web. That's good for anybody viewing it on their screen. It's even better than you need for mailing, obviously, but even with the compression, there was no way it was going to be small enough to mail. So I went with that. Clearly, if somebody wanted to take one of the images and print it, I would recommend to them that no, they don't use that. Just write you directly. You can send them a good quality a JPEG and they can print that. Next. So if you know the person doesn't have PowerPoint, whatever reason, the environment they're in, you can also provide them a PDF that anybody could read with Adobe or Foxit Reader or anything like that. So you just go to your print screen, and instead of printing to my brother printer, I click on the arrow and I do Microsoft Print to PDF. And then that's really easy. That's very small. You might even be able to mail that one, but I usually just post it on the same place where I'm posting the PowerPoint. Next.
That's it, Luna.
That's it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so Tom had asked whether PowerPoint was easy to run off the internet, but I think you covered that.
One note, you can also, one of the things you can do in PowerPoint, and there may be others, but one of the things you can do is crop the pictures so that, for example, you can bring in a bunch of the pictures that you haven't edited or changed in any way, and you can crop them, well, to fit the frame or to highlight the people. So that's one advantage of PowerPoint.
Yes, and there are quite a few lighting adjustments you can make in PowerPoint. And one of the ones I like is just adding a bit of contrast. And there's degrees of variations of contrast you can add. It gives you quite a large menu. And sometimes you're just like, oh, crap, I forgot to add the contrast on that one. Do I want to go back to my photo editing program? No, I'll just do a quick one in PowerPoint. So thanks for the reminder, Tom.
And Carol wants to know, she says she's doing a 50th reunion PowerPoint, and she'd like to add music.
Yes, I was going to mention that I did a presentation probably almost 2 years ago now, I guess, on how you can actually videotape a PowerPoint while you're giving it, and you can have music in the background. I don't know. I can't exactly remember how it worked. I think you have to actually have the music running while the PowerPoint is going and tape that, and then I'm not sure how you would get that into a loop. I'd have to think about it. I don't think you can add it automatically and have it go into a loop like the slides, but if anybody
you can. You can add audio media to a PowerPoint presentation as well and have it run
and it will loop
during it.
Okay. I just wasn't sure about the looping, but thank you. That's good.
So just to clarify that, Chris, you use one music track and it plays for all of the slides?
It's been a long time since I've actually done it, but I think you would, you can start it on the first slide, and I think the media, audio media will continue to play while your slides advance to other things. And then I think at the end, I believe that when it loops, it'll just cut it off at the end then restart. I think that's the way it works. It's been, as I say, it's been a long time since I've done it, but it is possible. I know that.
Okay.
One of the things I noticed on your slides was that you could actually, for each particular slide, you could specify a music file that would play while the slide is showing.
Yeah. I knew you could always do it by slide, but I think what you would want to have happen in a case like this would be just start an audio track that runs through the whole presentation, and then the slides just advance during it, and that's the part that I'm not sure exactly how it functions, but I 99% sure that it is definitely that is doable.
And if it's not, one of the things you could do is to create a movie file of the PowerPoint and then add an audio track in a video editor like Shotcut.
That's right.
That'd be another way.
PowerPoint, if it's native in PowerPoint, that's obviously the best way to do it.
Yeah, for sure. You could just put the two tracks in and line it up.
Yeah. And Tom pointed out how you could actually use Irfan View, which is by and large an image viewer, but you can actually create a slideshow in there, and you can actually have it create an executable that you could then share with other people. And that's kind of a neat way of doing it too. And then you don't have to worry about whether they have PowerPoint or not, and they will just get an executable that they run it, and it'll run through the slideshow. You don't have quite all of the fancy things that you can do in PowerPoint, but that may not be really necessary to do it.
Well,
so.
Especially if you're tight on time, that might be an ideal solution.
Yeah.
And everybody can use it. As you say, you don't have to worry about them having PowerPoint. And when I first started making it, I wasn't even thinking that I would necessarily share it. I was just thinking, okay, this will be for the event. But then when you realize so many people can't always come from various parts of the country, I got thinking more, well, how can I make sure that everybody can access this?
Yeah, PDF is a safe way for sure on that. Anybody can read a PDF file.
And then people did see pictures. So I had three relatives say, oh, can you send me the picture on slide 16, 20? And then, you know, and so that was easy. I just flipped the photos to the ones that they wanted. And very easy.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, Linda, you don't necessarily have to use your printer. PowerPoint has an export PDF directly.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Linda. That's really good.
We have a comment from Jeff that PowerPoint used to have a free PowerPoint viewer, which allows you to view PowerPoint shows, but no edit. They may still have that. I know of when they had it way back when, but I personally don't know if there is still a viewer. I'll look it up while we're going on. Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, well, sticking on the topic of PDF conversions, we had a question came in from B this afternoon, and she wanted to know if there's a free app which will convert a PDF file to either Microsoft Word or Excel. And this is one of those, it depends. It's what Chris always says, it depends, right? Actually, I say this time it's sure. If you're trying to create a doc file, it's presumably because you've got Microsoft Word. Well, it turns out Microsoft Word itself will let you open a PDF file and save it as a doc file. And Chris notes that you can do the same thing in Excel. You can open the PDF, but it ain't going to give you anything very useful. But if you use Microsoft Word, and I don't know which version this applies to, but certainly the current version, and here's the current newsletter, the front page on the current newsletter for September, and here I've opened it in Microsoft Word, and I've highlighted the lead article here by Chris, and I put in a comment denying whatever he's recommending. And I trashed the whole paragraph here by striking it out and turning it to red. So clearly, once you have your PDF in Word, you can do editing. But the other thing is, note that the formatting is not all that great. And the picture used to be up here, and now it's kind of dropped into the middle of the page. And the kind of footer bar down here has kind of jumped up partway up the page. So, clearly things, but by the same token, at least you've got the text and you've got the images and most of the formatting's there. So it's probably usable if you want to edit your PDF files.
But if you bring it into LibreOffice, it comes in a lot better.
Oh, really? It didn't come in that cleanly in mine. In the end, I actually used my printer OCR.
Okay.
And that didn't bring in the symbols, but it brought in the text more reliably.
Oh, yeah.
And the spacing was better.
Yeah. When you say it didn't work well, was that in Microsoft Word or in LibreOffice?
Yeah, but I'm working on Windows 10 on an old Microsoft Word.
Okay. More modern ones generally do a better job. But in my testing, which I did when we had our LibreOffice versus Microsoft Office shootout, I found that PDFs actually open up really, really nicely for the most part in LibreOffice Writer rather than they do a better job in my testing than Microsoft Word did.
Okay. Well, it may also have been that this was basically a table and it had little squares that you're supposed to tick off. And so it wasn't just text.
Yeah, it can get complex for sure.
So it wasn't too happy with some of the lines. It put one line right on top of the other line. You couldn't really get it off. But like I say, I have a pretty old version of Word, so But the OCR didn't work, did work actually fairly well, except it didn't keep the little squares beside the items, so I had to put those in by hand.
Okay.
But so thank you. I never would have thought of trying to open it in Word.
If you really want to take control of bringing something into converting to another document, I found that the Power Toys OCR of a selected area on the screen is very useful. You can pick and choose and then just copy it into a text file, and it's very convenient.
There's a number of online tools as well. So if you Google for free online convert from PDF to Word, there will be a bunch that will show up. And so basically you just go to that website and then you upload the file. They convert it into a PDF and or into a Word document file and send it back to you. Your mileage may vary, but it's free. And so it's worth trying that out too.
The other option turned out to be you could get a 7-day free, like my PDF program is not the pro. And if you clicked on, convert to Word, if you did it all in 7 days,
there are some free ones out there that you can use again and again and again. They don't bug you.
I'll definitely look for that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Trying to convert some physio forms from one company to another, sort of. Yeah.
Right. So, Chris, when you used LibreOffice, did you use Writer or did you use Draw?
I can't remember.
But I know Draw works as a PDF editor.
Okay. It might have been Draw. I can't remember. I just remember being pleasantly surprised when I looked at the final result, and it looked remarkably similar to the original.
Mm-hmm.
But it might have, you're right, it might have been Draw. Yeah.
Okay, well, we've had a bunch of questions. If there's any other questions, we've still got a few minutes in our last 10 here. I don't think we've missed anything in the chat, have we?
Don't think so. I think we covered them all.
Jeff noted that the PowerPoint viewer was retired in 2018, but there's a web version and it still works on mobile devices.
Yeah, and I found a PPTX viewer in the Microsoft Store. It's not from Microsoft, but it is available there and it's free. So you can always try that too.
Tom Stew wants to know how you fixed your audio.
I have no idea. I have been using a program called OO Shutup, which turns off a bunch of privacy settings like telemetry and so on in Windows and Edge and a variety of other programs from O&O software. When I reboot, sometimes the microphone comes back. But what I did today is I'm using the microphone from my headphones, which I attached by Bluetooth.
Uh-huh.
I would like to say one thing. Moving to my new computer, I looked into a variety of ways to move my old stuff over. And apparently the only one that seems to work to move all your identities and the programs and your settings and so on is the Pro version from Laplink, which is about $50. If you need to move to a new computer, then I think it may be worthwhile to spend that $50 as I did.
Yeah, the alternative is to basically do a manual setup, install all of the programs manually, and then move your data over, which can be a long and tedious process for sure. However, I actually do that now, and I just decided it'll end up with a cleaner result in the end of it all. And it's an opportunity to review all your programs and decide, well, I really don't need this or this and so forth. So, but the other alternative, which I certainly don't recommend, is that some of the image backup software I use, EaseUS to do backup, and I actually have their paid version that says that it can restore a computer to new hardware. My highest recommendation is don't do it. I had lots of problems, and when it eventually finished days later, I was never confident that that computer was actually running really properly. So my experience with image backup programs doing this to new hardware, no, I would not do it again.
Well, my experience is quite different. But it is, you can't use the lower level programs Speedy or something like that. They have several cheaper programs, but you have to go to the pro version. And supposedly, although it's pro, you can only do it from one computer to one other computer.
Oh boy!
So it doesn't sound very professional to me. but it is effective in moving your identities and all your programs over. I haven't seen any problems so far. There are some things that are missing in some of the programs, in that some things are missing that I'm used to. I haven't noted them down, but it's 95-98% effective.
Wow.
It's from BlackBlink. It's the Pro PC Move or something like that. PC Mover.
Yeah, certainly sounds like it could be worth $50.
Unfortunately.
Yeah,
my usual approach is to do it for free or do it manually. I did try it to start with to move stuff over, but this was way more complete and effective.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Tom.
Okay, so we've hit the magic 8:30 time period, so going into the wrap-up phase. We're looking for some new ideas. I keep saying the cupboard is bare, it's almost bare. There's lots of cupboards almost bare at the moment. We're looking for ideas for Q&A. We need ideas for topics. What do you want to know about? I mean, we kind of throw these things out and we hope that people enjoy them, but if you tell us what you don't know, we'd probably try and answer it. And certainly if you have things to share, we're always happy to receive other people providing material so that Cliff and I don't have to. And in fact, we've got a few meetings lined up, the regular monthly meetings, which will start next month. And we do have a speaker for September. We'll talk about that in the future. And we have a few months speakers all lined up. But, you know, going forward, we're looking for, again, more topics. What do people want to hear about? And do you have any suggestions for speakers? Can you speak yourself on a given topic? And also, Bridget, I think, would like to see some material, some new material for the newsletter. So this month we have a full 8-page newsletter, I believe. But I think the cupboard is pretty bare on that aspect too. So if you can help in any of those areas, you can just send an email to our regular suggestion box and email address, and we'll take the appropriate action. And in the meantime, last reminder, our next Q&A session will be next Wednesday, which will be August the 30th. So if you have questions or if you have things that you'd like to share next week, the slate is pretty much clean and we'd like to hear from you. So other than that, that's everything I have, and I hope to see you all next week.
Thanks, folks. Have a good rest of your evening.